Good evening, friends, and welcome to Here's a Pioneer. This is the program, an interview brought to you every week at this time by the Pioneer Cab Company, featuring an interview with one of Alaska's distinguished old-timers. Tonight, our presentation is being wire-recorded at St. Joseph's Hospital, and we have as an interviewee Father Bellarmine LaFortune of the Society of Jesus. Now, Father LaFortune is best known for his good work in the vicinity of King Island and the Diomedes. Father LaFortune, will you tell me how old you are?
Right now, I am 78.
You are now 78 years of age, and how old were you when you came to Alaska?
About 34.
About 34 years of age. What year was that?
1903.
Will you tell me, are you a member of the Pioneers of Alaska?
I became a member of the Pioneers of Alaska when Father Hubbard and his friend passed a winter in King Island. I am what they call an honorary member. And they asked me if I would join the club, and I said, yes, all right, since you want to accept me. I had no other record but my being in Alaska for a long time, that's all. And they accepted me as one of their members.
Well, I should imagine that would certainly be sufficient recommendation. What igloo do you belong to? From what city? Is it Nome or Fairbanks?
Nome.
From Nome. Mm-hmm. Well, I can think of a lot of questions, Father LaFortune, that I would like to ask you, and I particularly appreciate the opportunity to conduct this interview with you. Where was your home, down in the States, or was it in Canada?
My home was in Canada, in Quebec.
Uh-huh. And you left there at the age of 34 and came to Alaska in 1903. What city was your first home up here?
That was Nome.
Well, you shouldn't call it a city, I imagine. More like a village at that time. What was Nome like?
No, they called that a town.
It was a town, huh? What was Nome like in 1903?
Well, like a large village, and nothing but that. A large village and stores and so on, all what constitute a village. There were stores, and there was a courthouse, and there was a jail, and there was everything that constitute a full-fledged village. It was not very large. It was about, the population was about, at the most, 2,000.
Were most of those white men or
white,
natives?
Most white. Uh-huh. Most of them.
Yeah. Now, how long did you stay in Nome?
I stayed in Nome. No, more or less, and around. See, I was not stationed in Nome alone. I had all the country around.
Oh, I see. You were in and out of Nome, and it's rather difficult
that
to figure.
That was rather my headquarters. More, and then the country around was Council and the Kugaruk and the Cape Prince of Wales, and then later on the islands and so on.
The islands, you mean King Island and the Diomedes?
Especially those ones, those two. They were the only ones.
When you visited the natives of that area, as far back as 1903, did you find them to be a particularly happy people?
Yes, they were happy people. They were not miserable. They lived nicely, and they had pretty decent homes, and they behaved better. As I said, they were happy people.
Their contact had been with whalers, principally, up to that time.
Yes, well, mostly.
And that had been going on for how many years? Perhaps 50?
Oh, that whaling, how long would that last, that whaling? Winning business, I don't know. Maybe 50 years or anything else.
Were many of the natives at that time English speaking?
Well, I could not call that in. They knew quite a few words of English in order to fight their battle, to buy their outfit and so on, but that's all. They could not read English, they could not write English either. They had heard white people speak, and they learned words that way. They could trade with the whites.
On the basis of your long experience with the natives in that area, Father LaFortune, would you say that the population over there is increasing or decreasing?
The population, on account of the sicknesses that came now and then, the population is pretty well at a standstill. But if there are many years without sicknesses, they increase. The population is increasing. The average family number is 5. That means that they increase.
Uh-huh. Now, is tuberculosis more prevalent there now than it was?
Well, I don't know how it was then, but it is pretty badly prevalent then. No, it's pretty prevalent. Out of 100 natives who die, which is at 95, die of tuberculosis.
95 out of 180 die of tuberculosis.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories of any particularly bad epidemics in the early days?
There are two bad epochs in 1900 and 1918. 1900 was universal all along the coast, and we don't know what that thing was coming from. And in 1900, that was especially around Nome, the what they call the flu, in 1918. But in 1900, we don't know where it came from, but it was universal. It destroyed Alaska.
Well, what was the nature of the disease, and did it affect the white man as well as the native?
No, they did not affect the white man at all. In Nome, out of 1,000 would die, perhaps one white man, perhaps. One, that's all.
Only one, huh?
Only one. And the natives say that the white men took care of them and so on and so on, and still they did not die. But the natives died, but the like flies all over. And this coast of Alaska.
Now, will you tell me something of the means of livelihood of the people over in that area, the King Islanders and those who live on the Little Diomede and Big Diomede?
Well, their means of livelihood are the sea, the hunting, and then the birds in summer, their eggs and so on, and the greens that they collect in big quantity for themselves in winter. They keep those things, those meats, most of the time by freezing in kind of cold storage that they have. They're natural or made cold storage. They keep their meat that way, and their greens, they keep them in oil, and they make big quantities of them. They have been analyzed by specialists, and they are considered as very, very good for their health. And naturally, without knowing why, but they make great big provisions of them.
I see. Do these people have any particular travel ambitions? For instance, do they have any desire to see a town like Fairbanks or Seattle?
All they will have the desire, if they could afford it, they come to Rome for that. They want to see those new things. They come to Rome and they look at the stores and they display in the stores and all those things, and they are very much attracted by that. That's one of the attractions of the towns.
I imagine when they come to Nome, they like to ride in a truck or an automobile, too.
If they can do it, yes, I should say. And even in a plane. Some of them use planes now. Some of them use planes to come from Diomede to King Island, from Teller to Nome, and so on. They use planes.
On the basis of your experience, have these natives had any contact with natives of Siberia?
Yes. They knew one another. As a matter of fact, there are families that were born in Diomede and they live in Siberia now, and vice versa. Every year they go across to visit one another, and then they trade also certain things with one another.
Are there some villages over on the other side?
Siberia, yes. There is East Cape, and there is place where they have the center of the Russians there, about 20 miles northwest.
Are they as well populated as the villages over on the American side?
That I could not tell you that. I was never there, and I was not very much acquainted with them, but I know that there are villages there. And then what is that center of the Russians there in Siberia? Whelen, that's it. The big Whelen is the heart of the Russians in Siberia.
Well, that certainly is interesting. Now, will you list some of the outstanding talents of the King Island natives?
Their talents are carvers, hunters, hide workers, namely slippers and things of the kind, work hide, all kinds of hide, and boat makers. Boat makers, their boats are unbeaten. They can beat those boats. Some white people, sailors, knowing boats perfectly, examined their skin boats and their kayaks, and they say, we cannot understand how those people, not knowing the art of navigation, could build boats so perfectly.
And didn't you say too that they have very great degree of mechanical aptitude?
Oh yes. They like to take things apart, and just like children, things apart, put them together again, and then they build them. They may, if we have the outfit, they can repair a tool perfectly.
They are good at imitating just as the Japanese.
Yeah, that's it. Imitate anything, give them anything and they will imitate it. And sometimes we make it better than the model.
Speaking of the natives of that area, I believe you recalled an incident in connection with a King Island chief's daughter.
Yes. Yes, I recall that moved the whole village, the whole camp. And if you want, I can relate to you that incident.
Will you do that, please?
Yes. When that daughter was a little girl, about 7 or 8 years old at the most, she was bright for her age, but not over bright, and she got sick. She got sick, that was a kind of pneumonia. And she got lower, and one day, the old chief presented her with the clock, a little alarm clock. And the little girl understood the number, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and she understood that. And they told her, what hour do you want to die? And the little girl pointed her finger right at 3 o'clock. And that was amazing for the whole bunch. Why did she pick that 3 instead of the others? Of course, the girl had been instructed and she knew that our Lord had died on the cross at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And they put 2 and 2 together and they said, no, that's wonderful. She wants to die at the same hour. And she died at the same hour. And that shook the whole village. Speak of that even now.
Well, that is certainly very interesting, Father LaFortune. Did you have any contact with explorers in that area?
The only contact I had was with Amundsen. I met him in Norman, met him in Fairbanks, in Mary Siglo and the Springs, before he went away for his last trip with Nobili. And the other explorers, Amundsen, well, I was acquainted with my privilege, but when he came and landed in Nome, I did not know the man. Only afterwards we asked him where he was coming from and this and that, and we found out it was Amundsen. It was the only chance that I had to meet an explorer.
What was your means of traveling to the early day missions?
Well, the boats and dogs and legs.
Now, what was the fastest trip that you ever made by dog team?
Well, if I remember well, that was one of the last trips that I ever took. It was from Teller to Nome. That's considered as 90 miles. It was at the end of the season, and I did not want to be caught in Teller. And I hitched up. That took me about 9 hours to make the trip. It was not necessary to say that the dogs were tired, and that time I was tired too, but that was the last trip.
Father LaFortune, how many times have you gone to the States?
I did not go once.
Do you have any desire to return to the States or Canada?
Well, no special desire, and I am no use anymore. I'm too old, and no matter where I die now, that's new material.
If you had this life in the Northland to live over again, would you choose it again?
In the same circumstances, yes. I wish it again. I don't regret it.
I imagine there has been many a satisfaction, particularly in the work that you've accomplished.
Yes, that's especially for that. That's not for the money making, but for the work that I wanted to. That's all. I wanted to train those people that they were honored for a purpose, and they learned it. They learned it.
Well, thank you ever so much, Father LaFortune. Friends, you've listened to an interview which has been recorded by wire recorder at St. Joseph's Hospital with Father Bellarmine LaFortune of the Society of Jesus, who is 78 years old. Father LaFortune is best known for his work on King Island and that area. You've listened to another presentation of Here's a Pioneer, which is brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company each Wednesday evening at 7:30. Wednesday evening at 7:30, and once again it's time for Here's a Pioneer, weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and the telephone number 24 hours a day is East 10A. Tonight's distinguished pioneer in this series is a man well known to hundreds of you in interior Alaska. His name is Luther Hess. Mr. Hess I must say that we're certainly pleased to have you with us in the studio tonight, and I'm going to begin by asking where you were born.
I was born on a farm near the village of Ilton, Illinois.
And what year was that, please?
1865.
And then how old were you when you decided to come to Alaska?
32.
And what year was it that you decided to come to Alaska? That would have been about 98, wouldn't it?
98, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to know something of the story behind your desire to come to Alaska in the first time. Did you come up for the gold or business prospects, or what was the idea?
It was on account of the depressed condition of economic conditions in the States and my desire to improve my condition.
Had you had some contact with gold mining before you came to Alaska?
Through my father, yes. He had gone across the plains in 1850 in a covered wagon drawn by a yoke of oxen, and had spent 5 years near Placerville in Northern California. And the stories that he told of his experiences had a great deal to cause me to come to the territory.
Then it could be said that there was something of the gold mining adventurer in your veins, and that probably had a lot to do with your coming to the territory.
Yes, sir.
Did you come up here alone, Mr. Hess?
No, we formed a small company of 8 people and started from Illinois to the Klondike in that way.
Didn't you sail from Seattle to Dyea?
We purchased an outfit in Seattle, and then took a steamer for Dyea.
What was the name of the steamer?
Alliance.
That was the Alliance. Did you have a good trip up to Dyea? No casualties, no difficulties?
There were no difficulties that we encountered on the way.
Mm-hmm. What was Dyea like at that time in 1898?
Dyea was a small village of tents mostly, and innumerable stampeders on the way to the Klondike.
Well, Mr. Hess, I've talked to many, many pioneers about coming up over the passes, but I never did get down to the real details of just how you managed the trip. Will you tell me something of just how you ascended the steep hillside?
After leaving the little town of Dyea, there's some distance that there is not much of a climb, but when you reach the real pass, you have to go a comparatively short distance over a very steep climb. The snow was deep at that time, and there were steps cut in the snow with landings on the side, and you had to climb that steep distance like going up a stairway.
I see. Was there some kind of a transportation service established there at that time so that you wouldn't have to carry all your own outfit on your back?
When we landed there, there had been a tramway, an aerial tramway built to take goods over the steeper part of the climb, and we employed what was known as the Dyea Klondike Transportation Company to take our goods to the summit for 5 cents a pound.
I understand. Then the air freight rates at those times, you might say, were 5 cents a pound. When you got down to the lakes on the other side, were the lakes in condition for boating, or how did you travel there?
No, the lakes were still frozen over. We established our camp at the head of the lake and got in logs, sawed them or whipsawed them.
Now, whipsawing, that must have been a terrible job, wasn't it?
It's quite a good deal of work.
There were 8 of you in the party. I suppose you had quite a bit of help.
Yes. We had to build what they call a saw pit, which is a high trestle, you might say, and place the logs on those, and one man would get on top and the other underneath. And by drawing the saw up and down, we had to saw our lumber for building the boat.
Now, when your boat was done, did you figure that you'd done a pretty good job, or was it more like a rough raft?
No, I think it was a pretty good boat.
Well, how did you make out with that boat? Did it serve you well in going down through the lakes and rivers to Dawson?
We had no difficulty whatever in getting through all of the more dangerous places, as they were called.
What means of propulsion did you use besides river current?
To get across the lakes, we had a square sail which was hoisted when the wind was favorable.
Didn't you recall that on one lake, you stopped, there was no wind in your particular portion, but you could see boats all over in other sections?
Yes, when we were about halfway through Lake LaBarge, the wind died entirely and we were left just simply drifting about. And one could see boats in every direction. I tried to count them, and I counted more than 150 in sight.
That certainly must have been the year of the great influx into the interior and into the Yukon, because 150 at one time is something that really staggers my imagination, because each one of those boats must have had, five or six people, didn't they?
One would think so.
Mm-hmm. Interested, too, in the rest of your journey. How did you make it through the White Horse Rapids and down the rivers to Dawson?
When we reached White Horse, we concluded that it was a safer way to hire two pilots who had had a good deal of experience in taking boats through. And we did that, took our boat through without any particular difficulty. The only incident was that the man on the front bow of the boat got his oar caught in the current and came near being thrown overboard.
He had to make a rapid decision there, and I imagine he came out on the good end of that deal, too. Well, that certainly is interesting. Now I'm wanting to know about Dawson. What was the first impression that you got of Dawson? Was it awfully crowded?
Dawson was very crowded. When we landed there, the river shore was just lined with boats for probably a mile or more, and they were four or five deep, and in getting ashore one had to go over two or three other boats.
You know, people of my generation somehow have gotten the mistaken idea of prices in the early days compared to prices now. I think that you can blame a lot of that on the movies, and perhaps you'll agree. Now, I'd like to know just what you thought of the early day prices, not particularly in Dawson, but also, the transportation fare from Seattle to Dyea near Skagway.
Taking into consideration the conditions that prevailed along the trail and along the route everywhere, I think the prices were very moderate. When we were in Seattle, I remember that you could get as good a meal for 25 cents as would cost you in Fairbanks today a dollar and a half. Other things were much in the same proportion.
Well, what would a meal like that be by the time you got to Dawson? What would be the price of it?
I don't know that I remember definitely what prices were in Dawson, but they were not any more than they are in Fairbanks today.
Well, that is an interesting comparison. How much did you pay for your transportation and accommodations on the ship in 1898 from Seattle to Dyea?
From Seattle to Dyea, the passenger rate, first class, was $20. And for freight, it was $16 a ton.
Well, I think that will be something to surprise hundreds of our listeners. Mr. Hess, I'd like to continue by asking how long you stayed in Dawson.
I stayed in Dawson about 2 weeks. I traveled around over the creeks and saw a good many of the mines, did some panning here and there where we were permitted, and then we concluded that our chances of doing anything very much at that time were slim.
And where did you go upon leaving Dawson?
Well, our party separated in Dawson, and four of us continued to continue on down the river to the town of Eagle, just a few miles over the boundary line.
Weren't you engaged in the legal profession at Eagle?
At Eagle, I was, after the establishment of the court there, I was admitted to the bar and started the practice of law, and was later invited to enter the district attorney's office as assistant district attorney.
And that's what later led you to Fairbanks, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
And what year did you come to Fairbanks?
We came to Fairbanks in the spring of 1903.
What impression did you get of Fairbanks at first? What do you suppose was the population in 1903, or would you hazard a guess?
I should guess that the population was 3,000 or 4,000. There was tents everywhere, and there were very few completed buildings. The only one that I remember seeing completed was the Barnett Trading Post and a small log cabin alongside.
I know, Mr. Hess, that you have figured prominently in mining in this area, but you are also well known for your connection with the First National Bank. Would you tell me how that came about in the early days?
Shortly after the court had been established here, I became interested in the mining game, and was later met by Mr. Sam Bonifield, who asked me if I would assist in forming a national bank in Fairbanks. We induced some of our friends to take stock in the bank and become directors, and in 1905, we formed the First National Bank.
Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the institution as we know it today. I would like to know, certainly on the basis of your long years of experience in the territory, what is your outlook as a businessman for the future of Interior Alaska?
I think the immediate future is very good, the outlook for that. But after a few years, it will depend altogether upon the length that the mines are able to operate until they are exhausted, and how the military post is conducted.
Then you would tie the future of Fairbanks pretty well in with the international situation.
Yes, sir, I would.
What do you think of the statehood proposition? Do you have any ideas on that subject?
I have very definite ideas. My impression is that nothing could happen that would be more to the disadvantage of the territory of Alaska than the admission of the territory as a state.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Hess. I certainly wish I had more time to discuss that and other Alaskan propositions with you. Friends, you've listened to an interview with Mr. Luther Hess, prominent Fairbanks citizen. You've listened to another in the series of Here's a Pioneer, a weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, brought to you each Wednesday evening at 7:30. Wednesday evening, 7:30, and time for Here's a Pioneer, brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company of Fairbanks, telephone East 10A. For tonight's presentation, we're pleased to deviate from the usual course of the program to present Mr. E.B. Collins, well-known pioneer, with a history of early-day Fairbanks and the local pioneers of Alaska. Mr. Collins?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I have been requested by KFAR to speak to you this evening on the early history of Fairbanks and the Pioneer Organization. The Order of Pioneers is historical, and much history is involved not only in the organization of each igloo, but the members as well. We know that the world was electrified when the news reached the outside regarding the discovery made by Carmack on the Klondike River, a tributary of the Yukon in the Canadian Territory, just above the boundary line separating Yukon Territory from Alaska. This news precipitated in 1897 and 1898 the greatest stampede the world has ever known, and Dawson became the center and was the supply point for this section. This exciting event was followed by the strike made on Nome Beach in 1900. Thousands of persons stampeded to Nome, and it was here on February the 20th, 1907, that the first igloo, Igloo Number 1, was instituted. Candle followed 4 months later, establishing Number 2 and St. Michael's on May the 10th, 1908, organized Igloo Number 3. These three igloos of the pioneers of Alaska met in convention at Nome August the 4th, 1908, and organized the Grand Igloo of the Pioneers of Alaska. The object, which was to unite the pioneers of Alaska and by a permanent organization preserve the names of all pioneers on its rolls, collect and preserve the literature and incidents of Alaskan history, and promote the best interests of the territory. But long before the discovery of gold on the beach at Nome, years before Klondike was discovered, a number of hardy pioneers crossed the Chilliwack Pass, whipsawed their lumber for the construction of poling boats at Lake Bennett, navigated all the rapids of the upper Yukon River, and spent the summers rocking on the bars of 40 Mile Creek. These men were truly pioneers, for to them is given the honor of being the first ones to find the key to the treasure house of the great interior of Alaska. Many of us living today have had an acquaintance with these men who have now reached the end of their trail. Jim Bender, Frank Bateau, Pat and Mike Canella, Jim Eagle, Mock, Matlock, Greenough, McPhee, Atwater, and many others. The result of the endeavors of these men was the development of the 40-mile section, the Circle, Rampart, and eventually Fairbanks District. Much history could be written regarding the activities of these hardy men who spent the better part of their lives developing this country and making it possible for the present civilization with all the comforts that go with it. Their trail has ended, but their dream has come true. The establishment of Fairbanks leads like a fable. During early occupation of the interior of Alaska by the Russians, it is apparent that these traders never came up the Tanana River above Baker Creek, and the first white men to explore the upper reaches of this river were Lieutenant Allen and his party in 1885. When they ascended the Copper River and crossed the Mantasna Pass to Tetlin, this was the first white expedition to explore the upper Copper River section since the murder of the Russian expedition in the vicinity of the confluence of the Chittenaw River with the Copper River in the year of 1857 by the Copper River natives near Chittenaw. Allen constructed skin boats at Tetlin, navigated and named all the tributaries of the Tanana River from Tetlin to the confluence with the Yukon at Fort Gibbon. Other than the knowledge gained by this expedition, little was known of this section until Captain Barnett, in the fall of 1901, contracted with Captain Adams, that pioneer navigator who has negotiated most of the waters of the interior of Alaska, to convey his outfit to the upper reaches of the Tanana River, the purpose which was a trading expedition solely. The boat upon which they traveled was the Lavelle Young. Many of the old timers recall that boat. On reaching a point above the confluence of the Chena River with the Tanana, near the old city of Chena, this expedition encountered what Allen had named the Bates Rapids, which extends from Big Dollar to the old town of China. And as the power of the craft was insufficient to negotiate the rapid current, Captain Adams backed downstream to the mouth of the China and ascended the stream until it reached a point a few miles above the present site of Fairbanks. When the water became so low that it was impossible to proceed any farther, at the request of Barnett, who had noticed a beautiful stand of timber on the bank of the river at the present site of Fairbanks, the captain unloaded his outfit at this point. A log building was constructed, and Barnett, with his brother-in-law, Frank Clary, established themselves in winter quarters. Afterwards, Barnett decided to go over the trail to Valdez with an Indian guide, leaving Frank Clary in charge of the store. The purpose of this trip was to procure better machinery and to construct a boat which could navigate the upper reaches of the Tanana River. The following year at St. Michael's, he built a boat, the Isabel, named after the captain's wife. With another outfit of merchandise and trading goods, he arrived at the previous camp in June or early part of July in 1902, and was surprised to learn upon his arrival that Felix Pedro had, in the meantime, discovered pay on Pedro Creek some 12 or 14 miles north of their present site. When the prospectors on Pedro Creek learned that there was provision so near their workings, and that they would not have to go 165 miles to circle for supplies, they were highly elated and knew then that the Tanana Valley held for them a bright future and that was eventually become a permanent camp. Then, on September the 10th, 1902, a miners' meeting was called on Pedro Creek, and after a discussion, a proper name for the camp, it was decided to name it Fairbanks in honor of Senator Fairbanks of Indiana, who afterwards was Vice President of the United States. Now, this was an important event in the life of this camp, and many of those who took part in this meeting became well-known and respected residents in this section. And we have today with us only one living member who participated in that meeting, and that is Otto Nelson. As one of the members, Harry Atwood, Bill Smallwood, John Madsen, Ed Quinn, with E.A. Smith, better known as White Horse, acting as chairman, and several others attended that meeting. The great rush in Fairbanks was in the years of 1904, 1905, and 1906, and it was decided by some of the active residents of Fairbanks that a pioneer organization should be instituted. A public meeting was held at the old Doherty Hall, November the 15th, 1909, and it was decided at that meeting that a subscription list for charter members would be circulated, and that the subscribers thereto would meet at Eagle Hall November the 22nd, 1909, for the purpose of organization. Pursuant to that resolution, the meeting was held, and the list showed 278 signatures. That well-known and respected pioneer Bill McPhee acted as chairman of the meeting, and Harry Cribb, another well-known resident of Fairbanks in the early days, was secretary. The meeting organized and made application for charter as Igloo Number 4 of the Pioneers of Alaska. Leroy Tozier, a well-known attorney, was elected president. J.F. Dillon, secretary. Other officials of this meeting are noted, especially the Board of Trustees, well-known residents of Fairbanks, all who have passed away: Harry Cribb, Dave Petrie, A.J. Nordale, and A.J. Nordale. One of the highlights I find in the minutes of this meeting is a bill for refreshments costing $99, $30 of which was for cigars purchased from Dan Rose, another old-timer. This shows you that even the early pioneers enjoyed a good cigar. It might be interesting to know that on the charter list appeared many names of those who continuously, through the 33 or 4 years intervening, still reside in Fairbanks, and several are still active members in this igloo. Moose Bill Betzler, Tom Gibson, John Kelly, J.L. Tobin, W.H. Gilster, Billy Cruikshank, Charlie Lynn, Henry Rappold, H.A. Weir, Roy Maddox, J.H. Grove, Dr. Sutherland, E.A. Smith, Charles E. Taylor, and Joe Quigley, and others. It is also interesting to know that the membership roll of Igloo No. 4 carries many distinguished names. Men who have accomplished certain important endeavors which have entitled them to special mention. Felix Pedro, the discoverer of this camp. You are all familiar with the story of that intrepid prospector with the wanderlust, always wanting to investigate the land on the other side. James Wickersham, the best-known jurist in Alaska, at one time delegate to Congress, the author of the Alaska Railroad Bill, which resulted in the construction of the railroad from Tidewater to Fairbanks. It was he who conceived the idea of the great university here in the interior of Alaska for the education of Alaskan youth. The honorary membership role of Igloo No. 4 carries many other important persons who have achieved distinction in the development and upbuilding of this great interior. Alfred Brooks, one of the first government geologists, Captain G.H. Wilkins and Ben Ileson of Polar Flight fame, Harold Gillam and Percy Hubbard, pioneer aviators, and who made many emergency flights to outlying sections to rescue the sick or wounded, Colonel Rathjen, chief engineer of the United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company, P.J. Murray, government botanist, Warren G. Harding, president of the United States, Colonel Fred Mears, railroad builder, Donald McDonald, the father of the International Highway, and many others, including the Black Wolf Squadron, the first mass flight ever made from continental United States to the territory, nearly all of whom were killed in the line of duty, Captain H.D. Douglas, Captain St. Clair Street, Lieutenant C.C. Nutt, Lieutenant Eric H. Nelson, Lieutenant Ross Kirkpatrick, Lieutenant C.E. Crumrine, Sergeant Jimmy E. English, Sergeant Edmund Henriquez. The foregoing is but a cursory view of the events which have occurred since the stampede of 97 and 98. The development of the resources of this great land of ours. The pioneers of Alaska have always been first in the advancement of the program of development, first in the preservation of the history of the achievements of those wonderful men who have led the vanguard of civilization in the North, and first to the rescue of the needy, and their service to this end is admired and revered by those who have come after them. It was left to the pioneers of Alaska to designate the floral emblem, the official flower for the territory of Alaska. It was Mrs. Esther Birdsall Darling of Nome, one of the foremost pioneer women of the Seward Peninsula, who dedicated a beautiful poem to the forget-me-not. At the instigation of the pioneers of Alaska, an act was passed in 1917 session of the territorial legislature, making the little flower which blossoms forth on every hill and dale in this great territory of ours, the forget-me-not, our official flower. The act reads as follows: Whereas, through her more than 500,000 square miles of territory, stretching from the Pacific to the Arctic Ocean and from Canada's border to the Bering Sea, Alaska has a wildflower which grows on every hill and every valley. And whereas this flower is emblematic of the quality of constancy and dominant trait of the intrepid pioneers, who in spite of all insurmountable obstacles and insufferable hardships have opened for development a nation's treasure house, and whereas the Grand Igloo of the Pioneers of Alaska have endorsed this floral gem as the territorial flower of Alaska, therefore be it enacted by the legislature of the Territory of Alaska, Section 1, that the wild native forget-me-not is hereby made, designated, and declared to be the territorial flower and floral emblem of the Territory of Alaska. This act was approved April 28, 1917, and the poem of Esther Birdsall Darling follows. So in thinking for an emblem for this empire of the North, we will choose this azure flower, that the golden rays brings forth.
Seven 7:30 on a Wednesday evening is time for Here's a Pioneer. It's a weekly interview presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, operated by Joe Coble, and as you know, their stand is located across from the Nordale Hotel. Telephone number, 24 hours per day, is East 10A. And this week's distinguished pioneer for the program Here's a Pioneer is a man who came to the territory 47 years ago, and his name is Mr. Cecil H. Clegg, better known as Judge Clegg. Judge Clegg, I'd like to ask you first, what was your home state before coming to the territory?
Colorado.
You're a man from Colorado, and will you tell us something of the circumstances which made you aim in the direction of Alaska?
Well, I had two brothers who had participated in the stampede to the Klondike. And in communication with them, they advised me that perhaps there would be an opening for an attorney at Nome.
Oh, I see. Then you, at that time, were practicing there in Colorado.
Well, I was associated with the office of General Charles H. Toll and had just been graduated. Just been admitted to the bar in Colorado in the previous year of 99.
Oh, is that right? Well, then I imagine at that time, fresh out of school, you weren't the least bit averse to making a little quick money up here in the North Country. How about that?
Well, that was my main intention.
Where did you leave from down there?
I left from Denver to San Francisco and took a boat there known as the Steamship Ohio.
And you were going to Nome then?
I was heading for Nome, mm-hmm. Yes. Sir.
Any adventures in connection with that trip?
Well, it was quite an eye-opener to me to see a big city like San Francisco, having heard so much about it in the past as a gold-producing section of the United States.
Mm-hmm. How about your ocean voyage? Was it crowded, and did you have any hardships?
Oh, we had about over 600 voyagers, stampeders, mm-hmm. on the Steamship Ohio, some of whom are in this vicinity today that I remember.
Would you name them, please?
Yes. Leonard Cepola.
Is that right?
Was a fellow passenger, and Pete Peterson, who has been a resident of Fairbanks for 25 or 30 years as chief guard in the federal jail. Mm-hmm.
Now, understand that when you did get up to Nome, you couldn't very readily go ashore. There was a little difficulty there, wasn't there?
Well, there was a great threat of an epidemic of smallpox. Mm-hmm. And all the people who landed within a week or 10 days of the time we did at Nome were ordered to be vaccinated and not permitted to land for a period of perhaps a week or two.
That must have been pretty disappointing. Now, did some of the people become ill from vaccination?
Some were very seriously sick, and not only from the effects of the vaccination, but just the mere threat of it. And a companion, whose name I forget, who was in the same stateroom with me, was so scared of the operation that it killed him.
You mean the very thought of the needle was enough to do him unto death then?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. The power of suggestion.
Yes.
Well, how did you find Nome when you got ashore there, and what sort of work did you do there?
I landed there, or we landed there, about 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, and it was, of course, light at that time in the month of June, latter part of June. And the main rush with everybody was to find a place to locate. Mm-hmm. And I pitched a tent on some property that apparently later I discovered belonged to other people. And the next morning I was ordered off as a trespasser.
Did you encounter any interesting cases during your time at Nome?
Well, I was working later in the office of Judge Charles S. Johnson, who had been employed by the original stakers of Anvil Creek and Dexter Creek in Nome as their attorney. And they were engaged all the time that I was working for them, about at least 14 months, in representing these original stakers of the ground. This ground had been jumped by other people who claimed that the original stakers of the claims were not citizens of the United States and were not authorized to hold mining ground.
That's the famous case that was described in Rex Beach's book, The Spoilers, isn't it?
Yes.
Did you think that he did an accurate job of describing what went on?
Oh, absolutely.
He did.
Absolutely.
Did a really
good job. It was very, very true and correct.
Now, how long was it before you left Nome after arriving there?
I stayed there 2 years and was attracted by reports of gold discoveries in the Bristol Bay region. And I was appointed by Judge Wickersham as commissioner to go there, he having been ordered to make a visit to the Bristol Bay section by the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Finding it impossible, he wanted to send somebody there who was representative of the law. And I went down there as the first United States commissioner to Nooshikak on Bristol Bay, where a great many number of canneries were operating at that time. And there were many Japanese and Chinese employed as workers.
I suppose the law wasn't very welcome in those communities at that time, then.
Well, it was quite a surprise to find for those people down there to see a revenue cutter come in there, and it caused a good deal of commotion in that section for a while until they got used to the idea that the Department of Justice was stretching its arms out to see that the laws of Alaska were being observed properly.
And then after your service down in that area, where did you go?
The next year I went to Valdez on an appointment from Judge N.B. Harlan, who was then United States Attorney of the 3rd Division, and was appointed Assistant District Attorney in the 3rd Division at that time.
Mm-hmm. And then after Valdez, where did you go?
The railroad from Seward attracted a great number of newcomers into the country, and I was instructed to go to Seward and make that my headquarters, as there were a good many stampeders coming in there at that time to work upon the railroad and show their active interest in the development of Alaska in that section.
Oh, yes, I understand.
I stayed there until the following year, 1907, when I came to Fairbanks.
Uh-huh. And Fairbanks in 1907 must have been a kind of a bustling community, wasn't it?
It was a real town, although it had gone through the fire the year before.
Mm-hmm.
But the town was largely built up when I arrived here in the latter part of March, 1907.
I see. How long were you engaged in representing the Department of Justice here in Fairbanks?
Well, I was Assistant United States Attorney for about 4 years.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Altogether, mm-hmm. At different times. And the last time, I was a Special Assistant United States Attorney, mm-hmm. and was stationed at Iditarod during the stampede down there.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go after Iditarod? Did you come back here?
I came back to Fairbanks and have been living here ever since.
Mm-hmm. You spent some time at Ruby, too. That was a bustling gold camp, wasn't it?
Yes, there was another stampede down to Ruby in the years 1911 and 12, and I was there during the greater portion of the year.
Mm-hmm. Seems to me that you've had the kind of a job up here that let you in on everything that was really happening in the way of real activity, the gold strikes and so on.
Yes, I saw them all except those that occurred over in the 3rd Division before I got there.
Did you ever make any early day flying trips up here?
Oh, yes. I was serving as judge of the 4th Division of Alaska for about 12 years. And I was instructed by the Department of Justice to go to a number of outlying places for the purpose of naturalizing citizens, it having been reported to them that there were a great many citizens who couldn't pay the necessary expense, bear the necessary expense in coming to Fairbanks from distant points. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I visited McGrath and Bethel twice, and Wiseman, mm-hmm. and Ruby.
Can you give me an example of how high the early day airplane fares were?
Well, on one of the trips I made to Bethel, I went by dog team, and on another trip, several years later, I went to Bethel by airplane, and there were very few airplanes operating at that time. And the charter price for one of the trip that I made by airplane was $1,500.
$1,500 to Bethel.
And return.
That really was something. I understand that you are the number one permanent settler for Harding or Salchak at Lake. Understand that there was quite an Indian community out around there at one time.
Yes, as I said before, I judged there would be about 75 or 100 mm-hmm. people in the Indian village.
And since then, most of them have died out. What year did you first go to the lake?
I went to the lake in December, my recollection is, mm-hmm. of 1921, and was attracted to it by reason of a legend that seemed to be well known to people who had been familiar with mm-hmm. the location of the lake for some years. It seemed that the Indians used to, in the early days, frequent the lake for fishing purposes, but they had so many disasters in the way of drownings that they regarded it as inhabited by some evil spirit, mm-hmm. and they kept away from the lake from that time on.
Well, you're the white man who really pioneered the lake. How did you get in there? Did you build a road?
Oh, I had to build a road eventually, mm-hmm. because there was no nothing but a bare trail which was used formerly by some moose hunters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think our time is just about used up for this interview, Judge Clegg. I certainly want to thank you for visiting us here at the studio, and I wish we had two or three more hours in which we could discuss your experiences here in early day Alaska. Friends, you've listened to the program Here's a Pioneer, which this week has featured an interview with Judge Cecil H. Clegg. Here's a Pioneer is with you each Wednesday evening at 7:30, a presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company.